Well, good morning slash good afternoon. It's wonderful to see so many people here. I can't imagine exactly why. It's a pleasure to introduce the second of the director's lectures on the future of the nation state. This is, of course, not a small question, but a very substantial question. I've known Tony Giddens since 1974. When I first met him in Boston, the occasion was a lecture, something like this, and it was during lunchtime. But on that occasion, what I remember about the lecture was two things. He was eating a submarine sandwich as big as any sandwich I've ever seen, while speaking coherently about future trajectories in social and political theory. I think I wasn't quite sure which impressed me the most, but the double act was very impressive. And we know that there are many presidents of the United States that were not able to bring off such twofold acts at the same time. It's a great pleasure, as I say, to introduce the second of these lectures. Tony has been at the forefront of debate in social and political theory, really, for over three decades. That's a truly remarkable feat, and it's a testimony to three things, really. His energy, which is second to none, his intellect, which has kept going throughout all those three decades, and finally, the fact that he's constantly in touch with contemporary debates in political and public issues. Well, today is a very, as I said, another major topic, and we welcome you and look forward to what you have to say, Tony.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. Can I introduce you to him?
I'm
very pleased that David's chairing this event, and each of these lectures, we're going to follow the same format. That is, there'll be a senior member of the LSE academic faculty chairing it, peppering me with, if you can say peppering, with two questions afterwards, and then time for two or three questions from the audience. David Held is Professor of Government at the LSE. He's probably the global expert on globalization. Since the globalization debate is a thread running through all the five lectures I'm giving, since I feel it has to be a thread running through all of your work, people sitting here, because it is the debate of the time, really, you have to turn to David's books if you want elucidation of it. And his main book is called Global Transformations. It's down on the reading list, which, as I mentioned, is reading list on the website for these lectures. And Global Transformations is probably the most sophisticated discussion of globalization available. It's complemented by a reader, also very sophisticated. And David, you can give me the money afterwards for my cut of that.
I think we should stop this now. And get on.
Well, my theme today, and again, I'll just repeat, it's very nice to see so many people here, as David said. My theme today is the future of the nation state. To talk about the future of the nation state, you must also talk about its past, because you can't understand what is likely to happen to a global institution like the nation state unless you have some sense of how it's evolved over the past 200 years or so. LSE, as I noted last time, and I see everyone sitting here and we're just talking about with a few people just for the lecture, very cosmopolitan institution. So I could easily ask people here, where are you from? I think if I did ask you, well, I did ask some of you in that little group, where are you from? I don't think you'd normally answer by giving a regional response. I don't think you'd normally answer by saying, I'm from Latin America, or I'm from Asia, or I'm from Africa, or I'm from Europe. You would say that you're from a particular country, and when you say you're from a particular country, you mean a particular nation or nation state. And I think the fact that you would give this response shows that national identity, one's feeling of belonging to a national community, is still a very powerful thing in our lives. And this will be the substance of what I have to argue in this lecture, largely against those who today deny that this is so. The denial of the continuing importance of the nation state is very much part of the debate about globalization entering the global age that I discussed in the previous lecture. And some of the figures that I briefly mentioned in that lecture, without developing what they have to say, have written devastating critiques of the role of the nation, a kind of indictment plus analytical conclusions about the role of the nation, which are very, very important to address. These are authors who speak essentially of the end of the nation state. On my books, by bookshelves. I've got three books, no less than three books, there may even be more, called The End of the Nation State. And this theme, very, very much part of the wider debate about what it means to live in a more global society. A good example is the celebrated Japanese author who I think I briefly did mention last time. Don't know if I can make any of this technology work, not being a technological person. Yeah.
Very good.
Kenichi Omai. He's written several books on this theme. He's one of the most famous authors, really, who's announced this from something like 20 years back. So it's not as if something he discovered recently. He invented the idea of the borderless economy, and he is one of the authors who actually has written a book called The End of the Nation State. What is the thesis here? Well, the thesis is that in the increasingly integrated global economy, which we discussed last time, other actors replace the nation as the prime actors, not just on the world stage, but also in our local and even our personal lives too. According to Omai, the advance of markets, the advance of economic interdependence, the advance of economic regionalism, which we also discussed last time, these things subvert the traditional power of the nation state. And we're likely to see really major realignments of the role of the nation state in coming years, at least according to him. So that, like some other writers, he argues that within like two or three decades, you might see nation states largely replaced by city states. We might have something like, he's written in one particular context, several hundred city states who have a loose attachment to what used to be the nation state of which they're a part, but which find their identity primarily from involvement in the global economy and their separate nature of that involvement, which the forces we discussed last time tend to promote. So if you think of some of the examples, like the instance of Hong Kong or instance of Barcelona I mentioned last time, or even big cities like New York and London, Omai argues they find their economic, political, cultural identity more from their involvement as global cities within the world economy and the wider world society than they do from the nations of which they're a part. The borderless economy is therefore for him a reality, and with it follows the large-scale disappearance of the significance of the borders associated with nation states. It's a challenging thesis, and I don't think it's now, by now, a particularly unconventional one. I think, as everyone here will probably know, it relates quite closely to what people are now saying about government and political power. Many people are saying that the state and government have lost the role that they used to have, national state and national government, that many people feel disaffected with politics. That's why they're joining up, for example, with anti-globalization movements, because democracy has sort of been eroded by the advent of decision-making, which no longer happens from within the orthodox public sphere as defined by the nation in traditional political theory. And David himself, who has, I think, a much more sophisticated position on this, I should hasten to say, has written about these phenomena very interestingly. The problem of sustaining the national public sphere in a world where so many issues and so many problems do not originate within the sphere of national government. So this thesis is a very prevalent one, and I believe it's shared by some of the protesters on the streets, because protesters are also saying, well, look, the whole world's been invaded by corporate power, the whole world's been invaded by markets. It takes away the framework of democratic legitimacy with which we should exist, and that framework of democratic legitimacy has to be national. I'd suggest to you that, as it were, the far right and the far left are reunited on this theme. Far right movements around the world want to recapture the power of the nation state in the face of what they see to be the forces which are kind of hollowing it out or undermining some of its pre-established power. So this debate is a really, really important one. And as the comments I made at the beginning suggest, it's not just a debate about structures, it's a debate about identity, who we are, how we feel, where we belong, what kind of community we belong to, how we define our prime identities and so forth. Now, to get a position on it, I think there are two things one has to do. One can be done fairly shortly, the other, I think, needs to be done in a bit more detail. First, we have to make some conceptual distinctions to sort our way through the nature of this debate. Specifically, we have to distinguish between the nation state, the nation, and nationalism. These three are often merged, and often this is simply done in a shorthand way, and you can have some sympathy for that, but conceptually, it's crucial to distinguish them because they often have a different momentum. They don't necessarily relate directly to one another. The nation state is above all a political formation. The nation state is a form of political order which is marked by certain characteristics that I elaborate in detail, or in more detail, but is essentially a political system which rules over a given territory, and that territory is defined by its borders. Nation state traditionally has had control over an apparatus of law and over an apparatus of military power. The nation state, therefore, is a political formation. The nation is the symbolic community associated, but not inevitably associated, for reasons I'll talk about later, with the nation state. The nation is what gives you your feeling of identity when you answer a question to me about who are you or where you are from, when you say I'm Mexican or I'm Indian or I'm Chinese or I'm British. Don't see too many people who are British in the LSE anymore, but we're trying to hold the line on that, as I was also mentioning earlier. Before starting the lecture itself. The nation is what the famous theorist of nationalism, Benedict Anderson, calls the imagined community. The imagined community is the symbolic community to which you belong. If you are a citizen of a nation state, at least in principle, it gives you a feeling of identity and it establishes continuity in history. As Anderson shows, and this is important, again, for reasons to be discussed a bit later, it's hard to create a symbolic community for the nation. It takes quite a lot of historical time to create a shared community to which people feel they belong, and it is constantly threatened. There are many divisive trends within most nation states. They can threaten the symbolic community, which is the nation. Third, you must separate both of these two from nationalism. Nationalism is essentially, as I would understand it anyway, a psychological phenomenon. Nationalism is your feeling of affiliation to the nation. Nationalism is the kind of emotional fuel upon which the symbolic community of the nation runs. Nationalism is a feel of affection, involvement, emotional commitment to the nation. The reason why you must distinguish these is that you can at least have one or two of them without the others. You can, for example, have a nation without a nation state, and this is something, again, I'll discuss at least briefly a little later on. And feelings of nationalism can fuel the aspiration to become a nation state, where a nation sees itself as a symbolic community, but is not, in fact, a state formation. Many examples of that around the world, from the kind of local examples of Scotland and Wales through to the Kurds and many other groups which feel themselves to, or many of which feel themselves to be nations, or many people within them feel themselves to be nations but do not have a state. Now, the historical background to the evolution of the nation state is absolutely central to grasping what is happening to nations today, and central to understanding what the nation state actually is and therefore what its likely future will become. The best way to grasp this is to see that the history of the nation state is actually much more recent than many people think, and I would include scholars within this because, in my view anyway, it's not shared by the whole of the scholarly community. Nation state is a relatively recent historical formation. It dates only effectively from the latter part of the 18th century. It is largely a creation of Europe or those societies which are colonized by the Europeans, like the United States or Australia, New Zealand. It was driven from this part of the world, and it was first established in this part of the world and then became generalized to others. So the nation state is not a state form, and nor are its other elements, the nation and nationalism, which have always existed. Anthony Smith, who is a famous writer on nationalism on the LSE academic faculty, has shown quite convincingly that most nation states do have ethnic continuity, or many of them do. Their ethnic identities quite often go back a long time in history. But nation states, as I'll describe them in a list of characteristics following on, are relatively recent. They might have their roots in the historical past, but they are not, they don't have a long-term history. This is crucial because what one's saying here is that although many people think of modernity, of modern civilization, essentially in terms of economic change and the Industrial Revolution, the emergence of industrial technology in the late 18th century, the nation state is just as much a part of modernity as modern economic industrial production is, a fact appreciated only by relatively few social thinkers, I think, but it's a central feature of what's happened to the world, specifically over the past 200 years. Nation states, therefore, differ systematically from the forms of state which have dominated world society up to the late 18th century, some of which endured well into the 20th century. You can draw a systematic contrast between traditional states and nation states. If you understand the nature of this contrast, you get a long way to understanding what the nation state is, or a certain version of the nation state as a structural political form. Let me run through five main characteristics. First, traditional states were segmental in nature. By traditional states, you mean states like traditional China, which endured right up to the threshold of the 20th century, or traditional Rome going further back, or traditional civilizations in Europe during the feudal period, those kinds of pre-modern state forms. Traditional state, first of all, was always, without exception, segmental. That now forgotten thinker, Karl Marx, described traditional states as being like a sack of potatoes. And in this, he was correct. This means that in traditional states, you did not have centralized political power. The power of the political center, even in the most advanced traditional states, of which China, for a long period, was the most advanced, the political center in traditional states did not have anything like the political power which we are accustomed to nation states wielding. This was because lack of communications, lack of economic, social integration made it really difficult for the central political apparatus to gain much power over the everyday life of the people who lived in those states, because you couldn't mostly call them citizens because they didn't have the sort of active part of the state which citizens have in nation states. So traditional states look very different in form from nation states. The rise of the nation state is marked by the consolidation of a centralized political apparatus of power. We've become so used to this that you don't realize how historically unique, really, it is. And it's, again, something subject to constant strains and tensions. Second, traditional states never, or very, very rarely, had overall cultural and linguistic identity. Of course, it's true that not all nations do, perhaps a minority of nations do, but cultural identity and the idea of the nation are so closely bound up with one another. In traditional civilizations, people who lived in local villages normally spoke different language from the ruling class. The ruling class had very little linguistic or cultural contact with most of the population over whom they ruled. Some people have said that traditional states were essentially a kind of apparatus of extortion. The central political leadership did two main things. It taxed people, and it forced them sometimes to fight in wars, but it was not an integrated cultural or linguistic community. Nation states, by contrast, always have this as an ideal, or virtually all of them have this as an ideal. There are some exceptions, like Switzerland, for example, but the idea of the nation is the idea of a shared culture and very commonly shared language. It's really important because some states that want to become nations define themselves precisely by these characteristics. So the rise of the nation state in the 18th century onwards, always influenced by the educational system, always influenced by the creation of the imagined community, which Benedict Anderson refers to, was created largely in conjunction with the state apparatus. And having a unitary educational system, as theorists of the nation state like Ernest Gellner, who also used to teach at the LSE, have always accentuated. Traditional states were not like that. Third, really vital thing, traditional states never had a monopoly of the means of violence. So that traditional states, like traditional China, for example, always a push and pull in terms of control of the means of waging war between the political center and local warlords. Local warlords, as you see in Afghanistan to some extent even today, still had extraordinarily local power because there was no process whereby the traditional state could monopolize the controls of the control of military violence. The process of monopolizing military violence, therefore, was again a really vital stage in the evolution of the nation state. And it's difficult for all nations to take this for granted because it can itself be constantly under threat. But it became a major feature, especially of Western European nations. And you can mark it. You can quite easily mark it by the rise of police forces. When you have the rise of a police force, the police force deals with internal security. And the army is only called in matters of internal security in relative emergency situations. Once you get that separation, that is normally a marker of the successful monopoly of the means of violence by the state. But again, you must recognize what an unusual thing this is in history. It's a very unusual thing. And in traditional states, you couldn't even travel safely, for example. If you wanted to travel even quite late on in this country, from say London to Edinburgh, you couldn't get on a train. Well, you can't get on a train now and expect to get there, can you? But you couldn't just travel to Edinburgh and expect not to be bothered by brigands or bandits or robbers, because they lay in wait in many different parts of any long-term traveler's movement from one destination to another. The state did not at that point have monopoly of the means of violence. You could say this is all returned, maybe in a kind of high-tech version, with what the global terrorist networks are seeking to do today. They're making travel again unsafe. They're again saying, well, are we really safe traveling to New York? But for many years, most people, especially in the West, have become used to safety and security of travel. But this is a recent development. It's not something which has existed for a long time in history. Fourthly, traditional nations. I was told off for looking at my watch last time by Denise Annette, who is the guru of PR in the LSE. And she said it made me look as though I was being bored, or I was boring the audience, even worse. But it's only to make sure I don't talk for too long, because I normally talk 50 minutes. And in these lectures, I've got to talk for 35, 40 minutes. So I need to monitor myself. So it's not because I'm getting bored with all you happy faces sort of sitting there. Fourth characteristic, traditional state. Traditional states had frontiers, as geographers call them, not borders. Again, it's hard to underestimate the significance of this. When you have frontiers, you do not have divisions on a map. You have graded areas where the authority of the political center gradually shades off. So if you look to traditional China had a wall around it, and because it had a wall around quite a lot of it, you might assume that wall was the boundaries of the state, but it wasn't. It was constant fighting over areas stretching both sides of the Great Wall of China, and the local warlords controlled that wall more often than the political center did. The invention of borders is something, therefore, quite unique in history. A border is a line you can draw on the map, and a border is a place where the authority of one state stops and another state begins. It was very, very difficult to set up borders. It's a long historical process. Sometimes borders were set by Western nations for others, as happened in Africa, for example, with consequences I'll go on shortly, at least briefly, to discuss. But once you've got borders, then you can say you've got an autonomous nation state, because the political apparatus of the nation coincides with the borders. And what's happening now? A borderless economy. Is this true? Well, I have to go on to see whether that's so. Finally, traditional states, and remember you're talking of most of human history here, or 6,000 years of it, I should say, and you're talking of something that lasted right up until the 20th century. Traditional states did not exist within systems of states. Traditional states normally were dominant in one particular region. They were surrounded by tributary groups, often tribal groups, who paid tribute to the imperial center, if it was an empire, or to the local lord, if it was a feudal system. Nation states, from their origin, have always existed within a state system. Being in a state system, that is, having agreed upon borders, for example, demands the agreement of other states. So from at least the 18th century, but to some extent in Europe before, you've always had a state system. That state system emerged first of all in the West, but subsequently became generalized over most of the rest of the world. Now, the history of the progressive implementation of the nation state, that is, the wrenching of history away from traditional states, which had dominated for so long, towards modern nation states, has produced dislocated consequences in different parts of the world. And these also one needs to understand before I conclude with an assessment of whether the nation state is disappearing or not. You have essentially three different forms of nation-state, nationalism combination existing today. First, you have the classical nation state. Classical nation state is the one that conforms most closely to the criteria which I just mentioned. Classical nation state is established above all in Europe, the United States, and the other areas through the world that I mentioned earlier, largely states or areas colonized by Europeans. Classical nation state then spread to other parts of the world. Some parts of the world became fairly well established. For example, if you look in, say, Latin America today, or you look at Mexico, it is now a classical form of the nation state with clear borders. But this didn't happen everywhere. So you have a second political formation, which is usually called state nations. State nations are states which were established before the symbolic community of the nation could actually be set up, or which have never managed to achieve a symbolic community of the nation. State nations normally existed in colonized areas where Western countries have colonized other parts of the world. They established the borders. They were established by Western countries. They didn't correspond to a generic historical reality, and therefore they've always faced the problem of creating an integrated symbolic community. The majority of state nations exist in Africa because Africa was the continent which was most clearly partitioned as a deliberate act by Western powers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. State nations tend to be more unstable than nation states simply because they don't have the association between effective territorial power and symbolic involvement of the citizenry. They tend, therefore, to overlap with different ethnic divisions, sometimes tribal divisions, which don't necessarily correspond at all to the territorial boundaries which were drawn up by the colonial powers. Finally, thirdly, you have a third category, which is nations without states. Nations without states are becoming particularly prominent on the world scene today, although to some extent they've existed for at least the last 100 or so years. A nation without a state, it's people who believe they belong to a given symbolic community. That symbolic community normally has the characteristics of the imagined community that Benedict Anderson outlines. In other words, you have a shared language, and you have a shared cultural history, and you have some kind of symbolic, partly invented history, but you don't have a nation state. Nations without states, therefore, have nationalism because they're a feeling of national identity. They have the nation, because they have some kind of symbolic community, but they are not states. They aspire to be states. And there are many, many examples, like the ones I mentioned earlier, say the idea of the Kurdish nation, it's distributed across several countries in Middle East. You have a strong feelings of sentiment that it should be an independent state, but of course it's not a state, and awful conflicts surround this. It doesn't necessarily breed awful conflicts, but there are many nations where at least some proportion of the population want that nation to be a state. And if we live in Europe, for example, we have sorts of issues about this. What will happen with Scotland? What will happen with Catalonia? What will happen with the Basque country? Can Switzerland hold together? Why did the Czechoslovakia divide? Will Belgium divide? Because I don't know how many people from Belgium there might be here, but Belgium is a segmented country in many respects because it's got two linguistic communities, the Dutch one and the French one. Most of the things you do in Belgium you have to do twice over. You have to do them in both languages, but each linguistic and cultural community has its own universities and had many forms of autonomy. So these things are proving very difficult to manage. So what conclusions can one draw, therefore, about the future of the nation state? Well, the backdrop to it has to be complexity of the situation, because the idea that there are kind of simple nation states, they exist and they're simply being undermined by global pressures, that idea is plainly much too simplistic. You have a whole series of different processes going on in the world. Some of them are long-term historical residue, others are plainly the result, the impact of globalization. So we can draw, I think, against that complex backdrop, however, a few conclusions, and let me list them quickly because I've got to try and finish within this novel format, at least novel format for me. First, the idea that the nation state has come to an end is plainly false. You could write a book calling it the revival of the nation state, I think, rather than the end of the nation state. Why? Well, because for virtually the first time in human history, the nation state is becoming a universal form. It's not only traditional states that have coexisted with nation states for many years, so also, for example, of empires, and you could say the Soviet Empire was the last empire, probably. Soviet Empire was a sort of commonwealth, if you want to put it in a more less pejorative fashion. And many of the communities which were part of the Soviet Commonwealth have now become independent nation states. It's plain that in some parts of the world, nation states are more powerful than they were before, and it's nowhere more obvious than the case of parts of the world where they didn't exist before, like Eastern Europe, where nation states have again become much more autonomous, or around the southern fringe of whatever, of what was the old Soviet Union. So it can't be true to say that nation state is disappearing. Nation state is closer to being universal form than it's ever been before. And one should remember that state nations mostly aspire to be nation states, and so do nations without states. You can only have nationalist movements if you have a nation state as the outcome of those movements. So nationalist movements almost universally want to form nation states, even if nation states don't exist in relation to those symbolic communities. Second, however, plainly, the nature of the nation state is shifting, and this is strongly influenced by globalization. It's happening differentially according to whether one's talking of classical nation states, state nations, or nations without a state. Nations without a state are becoming, I think, more pressing in the global age because they're more easily able to give voice to their local cultural identities. But I think it's fairly clear that the nation state is having to adapt to the threefold process of globalization I mentioned last time. It's having to adapt to downward devolution, which includes local nationalism and the pressures of nations without a state. It's having to adapt to loss of economic power within the overall economic arena, which means that today we have to situate the nation state within what political scientists now call multi-layered governance. Nation states are changing their administrative shape because they're being integrated with forms of governance that exist above the level of the nation, and they're also shifting patterns of regional autonomy below the level of the nation. I quoted to you last time the most celebrated dictum on this by Daniel Bell, nation states becoming too small to solve the big problems, too big to solve the small problems. That captures that adaptation. It doesn't mean that nation states universally are becoming less powerful, but it does mean that they're reshaping the nature of sovereignty, they're reshaping the nature of the administrative control of political power which they had previously. Thirdly, this is affecting national identity. National identity is being rethought in almost all nations across the world. It's being rethought because of the collapse of the Cold War and because of the wider impact of globalizing forces. Essentially, I think what's happening, at least in the more benign changes happening in the world, such as in the European Union, is that national identity is becoming partly uncoupled from territory. So the idea of the borderless economy might not be valid, or not wholly valid, but the idea that you can sustain national identity without the kind of fierce territoriality that used to exist in the past, well, that's part of the Schengen agreements in the European Union, for example. The European Union has loosened some of the territorial identities of its constituent nations, but it doesn't seem to me that has necessarily produced a weakening of national identity, but it does demand a rethinking of it. Fourthly, many of the episodes of violence we see around the world are associated with the problems of establishing nation states. Therefore, it's possible at least that the major conflicts facing us in the 21st century will no longer be so much nation state against nation state as they were in the 20th century. They may be much more the problem of weak states, how to deal with weak states, and the kind of invasion of international networks into state nations or areas where state power is weak. This is true of Afghanistan, for example. It's true of quite a few other areas around the world. The problem of weak states is no longer just a problem of building a nation state, that is part of the issue. It's also a problem of integrating the arenas within which weak states exist with the wider international community. Mary Caldor, who's going to be chairing one of these sessions later on, speaks of new wars. New wars are those associated with weak nations and associated, however, with the intrusion of international patterns of violence into those areas. And those are the patterns that we're likely to have to cope with in future years. And this could be not as awful as it looks, because it could be that the kind of massive nation-state-based wars that existed previously might become less common than they have in the past. Well, thanks very much. I'll now hand over to David to interrogate me.
Yeah, keep the mic. Oh, well, not a bad 45 minutes. He's asked me to pepper him with questions, but since time is running short, let me just ask two to begin with and then give you, the audience, an opportunity to ask one or two questions yourself. Do you think it would be best if I ask one or two, then we go to the audience, and then you sort of wrap up in about 10 minutes' time, so we can get as many questions out.
We've got 12 minutes,
as possible. So let me ask you raise two points, and they're very difficult points. Since these lectures are about the emphasis on futures, there are two things which I think are particularly pressing and challenging. It'd be interesting for you to reflect on. The first is about identities. You speak of us living increasingly in a multi-layered, multi-level political world, and I think that's right. The nation state does look downwards towards subnational regions, upwards towards regional entities like the EU, and towards global governance institutions. But even in a place like the European Union, where political elites have made the creation of a cosmopolitan European identity an explicit political project, even in the EU, that project has relatively fragile support. Identities remain stubbornly local. So is there an emerging contradiction, and perhaps a dangerous contradiction, between on the one side the dispersal of sovereignty and autonomy, the emergence of a multi-layered political world, and on the other hand, a focus of identity which remains tied to territory, to locality, to nation states? Most people don't think of themselves as Europeans. They think of themselves as rooted to particular places. This contradiction carries with it a number of political risks, and it'd be interesting to have you reflect on them. And the second question I want to ask is related to that.
Can't answer that one, because I'll forget.
No, you can't. The second question I want to ask, because I want the audience to speak too. I thought I'd never get a chance to use the microphone, so I've got to monopolise it for a minute or two. The second question...
I wouldn't have asked him, but I know he's going to be so dominant, you know.
The second question I want to ask is this.
It's a bid for power, and I feel it has to be resisted.
Many of the second question... Well, he is the director, but, you know, I have tenure, so I can do it. The second question I want to ask is this. Is that some of the most pressing challenges which face our generation, and particularly your generation, that is to say, the younger students here, are now global issues. They're to do with global warming and environmental degradation. They're to do with financial stability and the terms of financial stability. They're to do with the rules of world trade and how one embeds welfare and environmental conditions into world trade. These are issues which escape the boundaries of nation states. These are issues which can no longer be resolved by states. So how, again, in a world characterized by the first contradiction, we find the cultural and political resources, as it were, the authority to address these wider transnational issues when at the same time identity still pulls politicians towards their local constituencies and towards a political system that is, after all, democracy, which requires politicians to account first and foremost to their constituents, even if those constituents may have a very particular interest which cannot itself solve, resolve, and legitimate solutions on a more widespread global scale. I wanted to ask peppering questions, several more, but I won't now. I want to just start with those two comments, and then I think perhaps we could have a number of questions from the audience. Is there a roaming mic, or should we just roam around?
I'll try and keep my answers brief because of the time factor.
So let's have four or five questions from the audience.
The first question is a really acute one, and again, everyone should reflect on it.
Go on.
What are you going to do? We're getting to be a great double act here.
I want the audience to speak.
The first question, yeah, it's central to answering the second, surely. Can we build forms of governance above the level of the nation which have legitimacy and which can allow us to deal with problems, most of which don't come from within the sphere of the nation? Therefore, a great deal will hang on how far the European Union project is successful, I think. I mean, I don't think the European Union can ever be like a nation state writ large. It will never get the same kind of feelings of loyalty and identity as nations do, but that's no reason why it shouldn't be an effective governmental apparatus. And I think the expansion of the European Union eastwards, which is now certain to happen over the next 4 or 5 years, is going to be a crucial test of all that. But I take it that the European Union, therefore, is a kind of experiment which the rest of the world has to watch with interest. And, you know, you think of Mercosur in the southern Latin American cone, or you think of the free trade area in the northern part of Latin America, United States. These are all emerging attempts to respond to these issues. But we obviously have to consolidate global institutions too. And that's going to give us big problems, so everyone can see. We need to manage the global economy, but we don't really have legitimate institutions which allow us to do that too effectively. And that's why so many people are in the streets protesting against the ones we do have. It'd be fundamental not to abandon them. We need to solidify them, and we need to make them more representative of the wider world community, not to think of scrapping them. Shall we now open it up to... there is a roving mic going around. I think it's important to try and get hold of it.
If there are mics on that side, so let's have questions on the left hand, from this side to begin with. Anyone here wants to raise a question first? There's a gentleman down here. Short questions, let's say two sentences.
Do you think the European Union is a force of globalization?
A force for globalization, or reaction to it, I suppose.
I think it's now both, because the European Union essentially was a Cold War formation. It began against the backdrop of the Cold War. It was an attempt to defend a separate space for Europe between American market liberalism and Soviet communism. Today, it has to have a different role, and that role has to be to react to, respond to, and advance globalization. So I think it is both a response to it and an instrument of it. And as I tried to mention last time, this is true of most forces of globalization. They're not just forced externally. There's very much a kind of dialectic between active contribution to globalization and response to globalization. EU is a perfect example of that.
Any more on this side? Yes, please.
If the crisis arises from weak states, what can we do to make or help these states getting stronger?
Sorry, do you get the question?
Yes, it's a question, in a sense, that runs counter to some of your arguments, which is about maybe one of the fundamental challenges in the political world now, let's say after the 11th of September, I'm interpreting what you said, is the crisis of weak states, and the challenge, political challenge, is not so much strengthening global governance, although that might be one of them, but also nation building and state building where they don't exist.
Oh yeah, sorry, it definitely is, because an Afghanistan is a perfect example of that. After what's happening there, can an effective, decent society be built there? The international community is going to have to play a role in that. So nation building is still very important, but there is a distinction, I would remind you, between nation and nation state. So I think today you often want to build a nation, but you want to build a cosmopolitan nation which admits of different cultures within it, which is able to relate to other nations. Therefore, myself, I'm not in favor of either religious nations which define themselves purely through religion or too strong ethnic definition of nations as a symbolic community. You've got to have a more cosmopolitan outlook on that. But you don't want to build just a traditional nation state. That is, you don't want to go back to a world where armed nations simply confront one another. So you take Afghanistan or Kosovo or wherever, the international community has to manage that and has to probably have a sustained presence in some of these areas, not just a transitory one.
Can I just follow that up by one question? I mean, the process of secularization, the separation of church and state, of religion and politics, was one of the key conditions for the development of the modern state and the modern nation state. That condition is also the basis of religious tolerance, the diversity of the pursuit of different kinds of personal and public goods. It's the basis of the rule of law. Today, in the context of 11th of September and so on, we see that this is not a universal achievement. It's a contested achievement, and there are many cultures and countries that resist secularization on the one side and the separation of church and state or religion and politics on the other. The project, as it were, of modernity, the rule of law, human rights and democracy, does it to you seem to depend on this separation? And what happens, what challenges are posed when this separation not only doesn't exist, but there are peoples and cultures who refuse to accept the distinction at all?
Yeah, well, before I seek to answer that, which I'll do very briefly, can I just say, in the next lecture, next week, I'll be talking about global inequality. One of the biggest issues facing us, are inequalities increasing? If so, why are they increasing? What can we do about them? These things relate to these issues just mentioned. The question David asked, also a really fundamental issue for our age, and I hope that everyone will reflect on it independently of whatever I might say about it. I think that actually different religious traditions, it's a bit more complicated than David tended to imply, because different religious traditions have actually played a part in generating a state which is able to accommodate liberal values. So Christianity, for example, it wasn't just the retreat of the church from the state. Some values of Christianity also were involved in the development of liberal rights. Now, if you take Islamic states, I think the same thing is possible in Islamic states, because Islam began as a very liberal religion. The same kind of doctrinal possibilities are there as existed in Western countries. So I think it is possible to envisage a much more generalized process of the spread of liberal democracy, which doesn't prevent the existence of cultural diversity and also religious diversity, and that's certainly what we've got to aim for. So anyway, thanks again for coming and hope to see you next week. Thanks, David.
Sorry, just quickly, you can find it.